Okay. Welcome all for this first session of the London Aesthetics Forum in the new year. I'm very happy to welcome Professor Gary Hapberg, James H. Ottaway, Junior Professor of Philosophy and Aesthetics at Bard College in the US. And he's an expert on the aesthetics of Wittgenstein. He's published multiple volumes on different aspects of Wittgenstein's philosophy, and he's also the author of the Stanford Internet Encyclopedia entry on Wittgenstein's aesthetics. So I'm very happy to have Professor Hapberg here, and he's going to tell us about Wittgenstein, music, and cultural context.
Thanks. Thanks to Martin and for everyone else who brought me back. I had the great pleasure of giving a paper here last year, and so I'm really very pleased to be back so soon. And it's all worked out very nicely, so thanks to everyone for all that. It takes a lot to organize things, and I really appreciate it. I wanted to give a paper today that is an attempt to look into a number of Wittgenstein's remarks on aesthetics that are often regarded as sort of the remarks he made while not doing his real work in the philosophy of language and philosophy of mind. And they're often taken piecemeal and taken in isolation. They often, in themselves, don't seem to have the power of much of the rest of his writing, but I think that they are worth serious consideration in aesthetic conversations, and a number of philosophers have sort of asked, why isn't Wittgenstein more present to the contemporary field of aesthetics than he is? And I usually agree with that. Also, years ago, I did a book with the title Art as Language, and that led some people to think that I have a view, a kind of general view, that art is a language, that we can take a conception of language and see art in terms of it, and that there is a thing called language. It can be described in quite general terms. There is a thing called art. We can describe it in general terms appropriated from language, and the one carries over to the other. I don't argue any such view, as you'll see today, for reasons that I'll try to explain today. So this paper is in a number of parts, and I'll sort of give you guideposts along the way. I'll fill up much of the first hour with the paper, and then we have the luxury of the second hour to discuss things, and I'm eager to get all the help I can, as usual. So I'll start with the paper. Language for Wittgenstein is anything but a stable and fixed set of names for things. The simple model of ostensive definition as the sole determinant of linguistic meaning doesn't really survive the first section of philosophical investigations. Language, rather, is a myriad network of possible and actual actions that take place in particularized contexts, where the interconnecting relational linkages that emerge or reside within those contexts, those language games, he says, constitute in large part the meanings of our words. The relations constitute the meanings of our words, and they constitute the preconditions of our verbal actions. Now, this context sensitivity, as it's been generically called, applies to art and music as well as to language. Art that we see or hear or read is in considerable part, I think, constituted by those relational interconnections. I'll say what I mean by that in the coming hour. Thus, the idea of a stable and fixed work of music or art, directly analogous to the model of the stable word given invariant meaning by direct reference or ostensive definition, is, I think, equally attractive to a mind seeking organized simplicity and equally mythical. Works, like words, will take on and drop relational associations as they are moved from context to context, and, importantly, the qualities and characteristics we see in them will also change, as do their networks of relations and associations. So, indeed, Wittgenstein, I'll step into his remarks at 1929, Wittgenstein claimed in 1929, in the remarks now collected as Culture and Value, he claimed that this is true of his entire philosophy itself, this relational sort of focus. I still find my own way of philosophizing new, and it keeps striking me so afresh. That's why I need to repeat myself so often. It will have become second nature to a new generation, to whom the repetitions will be boring. I find them, he says, necessary. Well, what is found boring then, or at least needlessly repetitive in one context, will be found necessary and refreshingly reorienting in another. The body of his philosophical work, now he's talking about his entire corpus of work, is itself functioning then on an expanded scale, like the word and like the work of art, I want to suggest later today. In a later remark that same year, 1929, he writes, "The human gaze has a power of conferring value on things." He adds, "It makes them cost more, too, but that's another matter." The human gaze has the power of conferring value on things. The human gaze, of course, without exception, is contextualized. And as such, it will situate what it perceives within relational networks of words seen in this way. Wittgenstein writes, also in that same year, he writes, "A new word is like a fresh seed sown on the ground of the discussion. That is, it has, or will have, roots and branches that grow out through web of association. The word thus here functions just as does a relationally constituted object in the American pragmatic thought of William James, John Dewey, and others." There's one of the many links between Wittgenstein's work and pragmatism. And with this heightened significance of context in mind, Wittgenstein wonders about the contextualization of his own cultural ideal. He thus writes, "I often wonder whether my cultural ideal is a new one, that is, contemporary, or whether," he says, "whether it derives from Schumann's time." It's an important remark for reasons I'll say later. That question concerns, of course, the content, really, of the relational web within which his sensibility is located, and I really want to say more strongly today, I want to say by which his sensibility is constituted. So, section one, relational networks. We can thus glimpse in this one way of understanding aesthetic we can thus glimpse in this one way of understanding aesthetic difficulty or inaccessibility. A work or a school of works can be difficult from the contextualized gaze of one viewer or listener or reader precisely because the content constitutive relational interconnections are obscure. They're, or may be occluded by a false or inapt layer of relations, or because they're historically inaccessible. That is, to put it simply, the mind perceiving the work in question cannot gain imaginative entry into the world, you might say, of that work. So also in that same year, Wittgenstein writes, in this connection, he writes, "I think good Austrian work," he mentions Grillparzer, Lanau, Bruckner, Labor, "good Austrian work," he says, "is particularly hard to understand. Aesthetic difficulty." He says, by the way, when he wrote in the following year, "I once said, perhaps rightly, the earlier culture will become a heap of rubble and finally a heap of ashes. The earlier culture becomes that." But he says, "Spirits will hover over the ashes." Spirits will hover. I'll come back to that. I think if we keep that in mind, we can make sense of that in relational terms as well. That is, a culture disappears as the network of cultural relations that make works of art, architecture, sculpture, urban design, music, literature, film, and so forth, what they are. That is, where constitutive relations constitute in large part what we can see or hear in them, where that culture, that set of associations, dissolves or is gradually supplanted by a new set of relations and newly contextualized associations, becomes inaccessible. So the spirits, to use his term, the spirits that hover will then be precisely the dormant relational associations that are, in a sense, there, that is, they can be reconstituted by a similarly equipped historical or musicological imagination, or what the art historian Michael Baxendall called the period I. But without this, those relationally embedded properties lie unperceived. Wittgenstein, throughout his middle and later philosophical work, frequently employs the spatial metaphor of seeing things from different angles, and he's constantly concerned with changing one's point of view on a given problem or issue. This itself, I think, implicitly describes a fact about aesthetic perception. The changing of one's point of view, the repositioning of the point from which the gaze emanates, repositions the object seen, as in walking around a sculpture, walking around through and within architecture, and so on. And that movement will thus change the relational network, however subtly, within which the focal object is seen. So, in music, we can listen to a string quartet. Many of you probably do. If you don't, I highly recommend it. We can listen to a string quartet focusing on the cello, say, hearing the first violin not in a sense for itself, but rather against the cello line. And so forth through all the instrumental permutations, the viola against the first violin, so on and so forth, thus affecting a similar relational change sonically rather than visually. Differences of conducting styles, I think, can often be discerned in precisely these terms. That is, for example, Giolini, Muti, Caron, Bernstein have very different ways of bringing out or suppressing inner voices or internal versus top or bottom melodic lines. You can see a conducting style in exactly, I think, these terms. So here again, Wittgenstein sees his entire philosophical body of work in this aesthetic sense, really. And he writes also in 1930, so a little bit later, he writes, "Each of the sentences I write is trying to say the whole thing. That is," he says, "the same thing over and over again. It's as though they're all simply views of one object, as though they're views of one object seen from different angles." So, to place emphasis then on the contextual relational network that activates or deactivates relational qualities or properties runs the risk of suggesting that the object itself at the center of these relations is either interchangeable with any other similarly relational entwined object, or worse, in fact, dispensable. I want to say just very quickly, I think that widely influential institutional theory of art in one of its manifestations has made just that mistake. That is, it said, well, it's the relations that are absolutely fundamental. In this case, they're sort of institutionally empowered relations, and that's what we want to focus on. That's where the content of the artwork, in fact, comes from. It sort of throws the baby out with the bathwater. But anyway, to go ahead, Wittgenstein makes a remark concerning language, this is 1931, that holds considerable significance for our understanding of the uniqueness of the given aesthetic object. He wrote there, he said, the limit of language is shown by its being impossible to describe the fact which corresponds to, or he says, is the translation of a sentence, without simply repeating the sentence. So, this is to say, I think, that language, then, is not interchangeable. Paraphrase is not quotation. And to read a plot summary of the Aeneid is not to read the Aeneid. We all, of course, know that is true, but the question, of course, is, why is it true? To examine a chart, a chart on a wall displaying sonata allegro form, in the classical symphony, where the formal interrelations of the composition internally, as well as its formal similarities to other symphonies of the same period, are made vivid, to see that chart is not to experience a symphonic composition in the high classical style. We all know that. Why? Well, it's true that Wittgenstein does not expressly state the point here, but in these remarks on culture, his way of describing language very often gives the clue to his distinct way of thinking about music and art. The only way to capture the meaning that, to use his phrase, corresponds to, a dangerous way of putting it, corresponds to, or that is, I would say, presented by the work in question. The only way to capture the meaning that's presented by the work in question is to reduplicate exactly the particular work in question, and then, if I'm right at all about what I'm suggesting today about the relational determination of content, and then see it also from the identical point of view, and also with what Richard Vollheim called the same cognitive stock. Now, another way to say this is that the meaning is no more detachable from the work than is the meaning detachable from the sentence. The point is that the meaning content invariably will be contextually seated, a fact that the philosopher of language, as Wittgenstein is here suggesting, will have to accommodate or be condemned to systematically falsify or grossly oversimplify what the philosopher claims to be investigating and describing in the first place. So, to capture the full significance of an utterance, one needs to fully grasp its meaning, its constitutive relations, and not merely add up as a sum a sentence's atomistic elements. Thus, the thinker, the philosopher of language, as well as, I would add, the appreciator or critic of art, music, or literature, will be like what Wittgenstein described as the good draftsman. I refer here to a remark of 1931 where he says, a thinker is very much like a draftsman whose aim is to represent all the interrelations between things, succinctly stated. So one might easily believe that because the analogy undergirding this discussion just is the analogy between the arts and language, that the interrelations of which we are speaking are only constitutive of a larger verbal narrative, and thus in truth external to the particular works in and of themselves, because any such narrative would be, of course, about them, not of them, as a language about art, not art itself. But this isn't, I think, only a verbal matter. For example, one sees the artistic, that is, in a reductively verbal matter. For example, one sees the artistic actions invented and performed by Picasso and Braque by, as we say, seeing, that means imagining, later Cezanne landscapes, as we say with a spatial metaphor, behind their early analytical work. We see Cezanne landscapes behind what Picasso and Braque did. One similarly sees both the Aeneid and Homer behind Dante in the same sense. One sees the Palladian Villa behind Corbusier. One hears mature Haydn behind the early to middle Mozart. One hears Schoenberg behind Stravinsky's mid-career experiments with serialism. And then those are still only one kind of what we might now here call, in this context, external contextual relations. They don't all function in the same way. Wittgenstein thus, that is, these relations don't all function in the same way. So Wittgenstein thus also offers a powerful example of the significance for the determination of aesthetic qualities of relations as perceived within or internal to the work. Such cases, by the way, seen in this way, I think motivated very influential new criticism of the mid-20th century in aesthetics, and particularly literary criticism. So Wittgenstein offers a poem by Frida Schanz. It's a remarkable example, I think, so I wanted to include it for today. The poem is brief. It is this. Foggy day. Gray autumn haunts us. Laughter seems tainted. The world is as silent today as though it had died last night. In the red-gold hedge, fog monsters are brewing. The day lies asleep. The day will not awaken. Well, he then notes that he doesn't know if those first words, recall the first line, foggy day, gray autumn haunts us. He doesn't know if the first words, foggy day, or the title, or the first line. And it's remarkable how trivial, by comparison, the poem sounds if gray is the first word. As he rightly says, it changes the rhythm of the whole poem. I don't want to ruin it for you, but if you begin the poem that I just read with the words gray autumn haunts us, it sets up a sort of duple rhythm structure. Gray autumn haunts us, laughter seems tainted, and so on. And it really destroys the poem by locking it into a rhythmic sort of set of internal relations that without that opening phrase, which I very much hope is part of the poem, without the phrase foggy day, takes on way too much power. So he says it changes the rhythm of the whole poem. The relations of all the subsequent lines to foggy day, gray autumn haunts us, are altered so deeply that the character of the entire poem is transformed. One might say, if rather deftly, I think, or unmusically, that the words, after all, are the same, so the meaning is the same. So the poetic content can't have changed. But in truth, the structuring relations internal to the work change depending on the rhythmic template laid down by where we start. And so does the poem we hear. It changes in the same way. So constitutive relations are thus not of one type, internal or external, and the clarity of that distinction I'll come back to later today. They're not of one type, and they do not all situate the work in front of us into a network of other works. They don't all do that. Some, like seeing Cézanne behind Picasso, or hearing the Schoenberg behind Stravinsky's brief turn to serial composition, some do. Some concern what Wittgenstein called in the Investigations, Part 2, Section 11, he called aspects of organization. There's a lot in that, but I'll leave that for another day. So in speaking of his own work, again now in 1931, seeing his whole work in aesthetic terms, and the extent to which it is original, Wittgenstein says, having first said, I don't believe I've ever invented a line of thinking. I've always taken one over from someone else. And he adds, what I invent are new similes. Well, this is a remark, I think, that sheds light in two directions. It tells us about his conception of his work as simile invention, where what is invented is, as we might say, a new network of relational comparisons, and the kinds of recontextualization that bring about a new way of seeing the thing or the idea recontextualized. And it tells us, by extension, about one kind of creativity in artistic production, that is, one that develops within the teleology of a given style's developmental trajectory, and so in this artistic sense, it, as in his words, takes one over from someone else, as in Haydn and early Mozart, and yet puts elements together in such a way that we see a new set of relational interconnections, in a sense, new artistically embodied similes. Mozart's sixth quartet dedicated to Haydn, perfect example of that. So, creative curatorial work, like creative or inventive musical programming, would thus be both, first, taken over from someone else, it selects and exhibits, after all, pre-existing work, that's what a curator does, and yet, secondly, it is creative work in generating new constellations of linkages inside the exhibition. And so there's no simple answer to the question, is curatorial work creative? Well, yes and no. But of course, not all relational associations are legitimate. Everyone, I think, knows that, and the question again is, well, why? In discussing the case of his having very nicely framed and then hung in the right surroundings, the right surrounding, by the way, that itself is a revealing phrase about formal relational configurations, the right surroundings. Having hung a picture in the right surroundings and then feeling proud, as though he had painted it himself, or more precisely, as he corrects the remark, as though he painted just a little bit of the painting himself. He takes pleasure and a kind of pride in how he hung the painting, and then kind of identifies with it in a way. Well, he observes that this kind of relational connection could be no more appropriate than an expert arranger of grasses or of flowers coming to think that he had produced at least a tiny blade of grass or a flower himself. Whereas Wittgenstein adds, it ought to be clear to him that his work lies in a different region altogether. Of course it does. Aesthetic parallels are quite evident. The curator, who feels as Wittgenstein did about the framing and hanging, the conductor who feels himself to be speaking not for Brahms or Mahler, but really as Brahms or Mahler. Leonard Bernstein said something like that on one occasion. The editor who develops a proprietary sense to the point of feeling a creative ownership of the text, maybe some of you have had that experience, such cases show a category of relational interconnections that really go too far or develop without restraint or without an awareness of and respect for prior established relations. So we can make mistakes. There can be an incorrect way of construing an object with regard to its relations. So section two, the phrase, a certain sort of kinship, this is what I want to come to next. Shortly after the preceding remark, Wittgenstein returns to the matter of the importance of similes, observing that the truth in saying that a person's philosophy is a matter of temperament really amounts to a preference for certain similes. Such differences of preference underlie, he suggests, far more disagreements than we might initially believe. It's worth thinking about, I think. Precisely the parallel point could, and I want to say, should be said about the arts. Sensibility might in fact be, at least in part, a matter of preference for certain artistically embodied similes in the manner described above. And aesthetic disagreements would then be played out in terms of these differences in relational network preference. It explains more than we might initially think. So in connection with this, Wittgenstein notes what he calls a certain sort of kinship between Brahms and Mendelssohn. This is instructive, not only because of what he explicitly says, that is, that it is not that any individual passages in Brahms are reminiscent of passages in Mendelssohn's, but rather that Brahms does with a full rigor what Mendelssohn did only half rigorously. Beyond what he explicitly says, we see the distinct way in which comparative analysis, yet another kind of relational interaction between works of art, comparative analysis has the power to cast particular features of a work or a set of works, in, you might say, higher relief, brings them out. That is, it brings out a feature that may have been recessive or dormant in our pre-comparative experience of the work. Incidentally, by the way, such comparisons are virtually infinite, and that itself, I think, goes some way toward explaining the inexhaustibility of many, not all, many works of art. Now, there is, it's true, a heightened sensitivity, and this is not surprising given his work in the philosophy of language that is running parallel to these remarks in aesthetics, a heightened sensitivity in Wittgenstein's remarks on culture to the fact that art critical language can as easily mislead as lead. One suggestion implicit in these remarks is that there is a sense that works can speak for themselves. That is, it is though the juxtaposition of Brahms and Mendelssohn itself makes the point about the discipline and the rigor in Brahms. He writes, 32-34, he writes, in art, it is hard to say anything as good as saying nothing. Now, that would seem to suggest what has been discussed as a kind of Wittgensteinian quietism. I think it doesn't. This remark is written, I believe, with the misleading cases in mind. He overturns it within his own practice just a few remarks later, with a rather critical verbal encapsulation of the nature of Mendelssohn's overall compositional project. He says, if one wanted to characterize the essence of Mendelssohn's music, one could do it by saying that perhaps Mendelssohn wrote new music that is hard to understand. Well, this, I think, precisely captures in succinct verbal form the now evident relational feature of Mendelssohn's compositional work that is cast in higher relief through the comparison to Brahms. So with a kind of gentle paradox here, we come to see what a thing is more clearly by looking at something that it isn't. So what I think Wittgenstein really is most sensitive to at a deeper level is the danger presented by the power of language to make everything seem alike, or I would suggest to submerge beneath the smooth and uniform linguistic surface just the important and manifold differences that relational comparisons interactions between works of art bring out. Much of the language used to discuss the so-called problem as though there is one uniform and case-invariant question about all members of the class, the so-called problem of the ontology of the musical work, as though this is one uniform kind, a kind of entity, I think makes precisely this mistake, or it often does. It doesn't always, but it often does, and can lead people to make such a mistake. In 1931, he remarked on the power, and this has been discussed in the philosophy of language at length, the power language has to make everything look the same, adding that this is most glaringly evident, he says, in the dictionary, and which makes the personification of time possible. Now, what he says there is worth thinking about. He says, something no less remarkable than would have been making gods of the logical constants. Now, I think that abstract musical work ontology can be blind to our practices, and sort of, if you will, divinity-making in just this way, a kind of Platonizing influence I'll come back to later. And in the following years, 33 and 34, Wittgenstein would dictate his blue book to his select pupils in Cambridge, in which he warns of dangers presented by a contemptuous attitude, he says there, toward the particular case. This is all, I think, quite familiar, how a craving for generality can blind us to significant contextually seated differences, and the undesirable results of hypostasizing a substance out of a substantive, and assuming that a singly named descriptive term, for example, beautiful, invariably refers to the same property or quality with uniform and case-transcending criteria of correct employment. Because I think this is very familiar in aesthetics, I'll be brief on this particular point and then suggest something about what it means in a moment. He thus writes the remark, this is the same year as the Blue Book, dictations. He writes this remark in his notebooks. He says, if I say that A, the person A, has beautiful eyes, someone may ask me, what do you find beautiful about his eyes? And perhaps I shall reply, the almond shape, long eyelashes, delicate lids. What do these eyes have in common with the Gothic church that I find beautiful too? Should I say that they make a similar impression on me? A similar impression? What if I were to say that in both cases my hand feels tempted to draw them? That at any rate would be, he says, a narrow definition of the beautiful. It will, he adds, often be possible to say, and this is what's important for today, seek your reasons for calling something good or beautiful, and then the peculiar grammar of the word good in this instance, will be evident. So, a philosophical picture, a conceptual template, a kind of simplifying kind of heuristic, what he means by picture, a philosophical picture would mislead us directly back into the old presumption that if the eyes in the Gothic church are both beautiful, then they'll share a common property that is prior to, separable from, and only contingently manifest in those two things. The linguistic corollary of that picture, that aesthetic words are fixed names of stable properties, will mislead us into the presumption that there is no such thing, and thus no such thing of possible aesthetic interest, as the peculiar grammars of the words good or the words beautiful, and that thus, with a picture-driven contemptuous attitude toward the particular case, to use his phrase from the Blue Book, thus that nothing in this instance or this occasion of the use of this aesthetic predicate will be of any special interest. But if, like the particular features that are cast in higher relief, through the comparison of Mendelssohn with Brahms, if we scrutinize the details of the case in order to precisely locate our circumstance-specific reasons for using this predicate, what Wittgenstein calls broadly and misleadingly, I think, the grammar, then that grammar will indeed, as he says, clarify itself. That is, the particular criteria emergent within this particular language game for the exacting employment of that term in its webbed relations will emerge perspicuously. So in 1934, Wittgenstein, and so now art and language are moving sort of in tandem. In 1934, Wittgenstein enters into his notebook a densely compact three-word phrase. He says simply, Brahms's overwhelming ability. Well, if you've studied the Brahms scores, you know what he means. If you listen to his music closely, you know what he means. One can see at a glance how far one would be from genuine and deep aesthetic understanding, kind of thing you get from close scrutiny of that music. How far you'd be from genuine aesthetic understanding if one were to draw up a unitary and universal definition of ability. The word ability, let's define that. That is, the property named in all cases by the generic term, and then without the slightest attention given to scores, to the nuances of the compositions, and to the extraordinary musical intelligence displayed in treating the harmonic problems that emerge within those compositions, conclude that, according to Wittgenstein, Brahms has that. So you give a generic definition, you say, well, Brahms has that, end of issue. And the necessity, then, of particularity for aesthetic perception and judgment, the need to see what is in Brahms in the most detailed way in order to comprehend the grammar of this particular use of the word ability, is then only buttressed by the previous comparative considerations. On the irreplaceable value of such comparative considerations, relational considerations, that constitute the meaning of what we're talking about. Wittgenstein rather poetically writes in 1937, he says, the light work sheds is a beautiful light, which, however, only shines with real beauty if it is illuminated by yet another light, relations on relations. So, part three, embodied speech and embodied music. During the time of these remarks on music, Wittgenstein is making great strides toward a more embodied conception of language. I think many of you know all about that. He will go on to suggest in Philosophical Investigations that pain language, if you recall those passages, that pain language, rather than a purely cognitive description of the alleged inner object of pain, is a gradually acquired replacement of pain behavior. That has its problems, but I'll leave that for another day. But he suggests that it's a gradually acquired replacement of pain behavior. Now, this stands in striking contrast to the purely cognitive conception of language, adumbrated, whether it's endorsed or not, that is adumbrated in the Tractatus, where a proposition is conceived of as an atomistically assembled picture of a state of affairs. Now, this emerging variety of anti-mentalism manifests itself in his aesthetic thinking as well. This is what I'm here today to discuss, the relation between this work in philosophy of language and philosophy of art, and particularly music. And this link comes out at countless turns throughout his aesthetic thought in this period. But in 1937, he captures his stance at that time in a memorable and, I expect, for many people, familiar terms. He says this. I think many of you who are musicians will identify with this immediately. I certainly do. He says, "When I imagine a piece of music, as I do often every day, I always, so I believe, grind my upper and lower teeth together rhythmically. I've noticed this before, though I usually do it quite unconsciously." Think about when you're walking down the street. I don't know if you do this or not, but many of us do. Some of us do. You tap your teeth together, sort of in a way you're unaware of, to give specificity and a kind of determinacy to the melody or the rhythm that you're imagining as you're walking down the street. He says, "I've noticed this before, though I usually do it quite unconsciously. What's more, it's as though the notes I'm imagining are produced by this movement. I believe this may be a very common way," I hope it is, "of imagining music internally. Of course," he says, "I can imagine music without moving my teeth, without tapping your teeth together very slightly in a way that embodies the rhythm or the melody that you're thinking of. But," he says, "but in that case," you can do it without the teeth movement, "but in that case the notes are much ghostlier, more blurred and less pronounced. Later today, try it." it's a dramatic difference, I promise you. So it's of interest that this, I think, I hope, maybe, familiar mode of imagining music internally is anything but compatible with the old Cartesian picture of pure cognition within a hermetically sealed consciousness. Indeed, it is a direct analog to speaking inwardly, perhaps with a slight silent movement of the larynx, in contrast to the unintelligible pseudo-notion of inwardly speaking private language that only we can understand. By virtue, as is pictured on this misleading model, by virtue of the inviolable privacy of the inward reference that give the meaning to those private linguistic signs, this entire problem of private language and the incoherent picture that I just painted there. So Wittgenstein comes in his middle and later philosophy to see language as not only a contextualized but also as an embodied activity. And he sees music in the same way. So having entered into his notes the striking and single line, a line that is a reminder that I think can lessen the culturally deep plausibility of the Cartesian picture and the philosophical misconstrual of experience that it engenders, thus opening the way to skepticism, its more extreme variant of solipsism, that is, it's a line that blocks all of that very familiar way of construing a human being in terms of a hermetically sealed and isolated point of consciousness only contingently embodied and only contingently interacting with an outside world. He says in that remark, he says, "Let us be human." And he adds, "Language, I want to say, is a refinement." And then, is a refinement. And then, quoting Faust in his study, he further adds a now newly contextualized and now famous appropriation of the words. He writes, "In the beginning was the deed." Now, these remarks have the power, I think, to reorient our point of view in aesthetic, as well as in linguistic context, where they've been much discussed. And they recover a full-blooded sense of the practice-focused embodiment against the abstractions of a disembodied idealism of a kind that, given the inducements of certain linguistic forms, that idealism remains ever-present in aesthetics. And we can talk more about that later if you like. It would be easy, I think, here at just this juncture, dangerously easy, to pronounce in general terms that, given all these considerations, Wittgenstein sees music as a language. But that general pronouncement is would implicitly suggest that language, as I said in my opening remarks, that language is one unitary kind of thing, music is a unitary kind of thing, and the latter is analogous to the former. Now, any such generalization would fail to maintain a philosophically irreplaceable mindfulness concerning both the clarifying value of relational comparisons and the role contextualized particularity plays in generating sense and circumstantially generating what Wittgenstein called above the grammar of a usage, the grammar of one of our aesthetic predicates. Thus, he says in these remarks nothing, strikingly, he says nothing about the nature of music and the arts generally, or about their generic relation to, or structural similarity to, language. But seen in the light of all the foregoing, this is neither omission nor fault, he says rather things like this, it's 1938, he says things like this, writes in his notebook, he says, phenomena akin to language in music or architecture, so that's the subject, things that are sort of like language in music or architecture. Bach's music, he writes, is more like language than Mozart's or Haydn's. Interesting remark strikes me as immediately plausible. The recitatives and the double basses in the fourth movement of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, he says, more like language, and that's right, than other music. And on the same page of what is now culture and value, we find the comparative relational remark that a Bruckner symphony can be said to have two beginnings, once with the first idea, and then once again with the second. But then, and that strikes me as right, but this remark is then itself illuminated instantly. Recall the double illumination he referred to earlier. It's added to by the second light of a comparison. He adds these two ideas in the Bruckner Symphony stand together not as blood relations but as man and wife. Not as blood relations. Now this tellingly is not a comment about the relation, right, between the first and second themes of the classical symphony in sonata allegro form. And to further specify the illuminating relations that arise in this particular context of aesthetic judgment, he adds that Bruckner's Ninth is in a way a protest against Beethoven's, and moreover that it is rendered, as he says, bearable by this. I think I understand what he means by that to a certain extent. It is thus, by virtue of its protest status, not an imitation of Beethoven's Ninth. Then, that is illuminated, that remark is then cast light on by a further relational juxtaposition. He says, it is related to Beethoven's Ninth very much as Lanau's Faust is to Goethe's. And awakening still another now network of relational interconnections and the new aspects of the occasion, he adds, that is to say, as the Catholic to the Enlightenment Faust. And knowing the rich constellation of associations, he's now activated by this aesthetic juxtaposition. He adds simply, et cetera, that is, he's losing control of the number of relations and the constellations of associations. He's now, in fact, awakening. In fact, mentions here, in fact, aware that he's really occasioned a blizzard now of context-link associations. He mentions, as a reminder of the significance of the scrutiny of contextualized particularities, that lines from Longfellow, it's here that he says this famous thing, that lines from Longfellow could serve him as the motto, you recall, where he says, in their elder days of art, builders wrought with greatest care each minute and unseen part, for the gods are everywhere. Well, it's here, while he's talking about aesthetics, by analogy to language, that he's sort of mainly working on over here, that he makes that remark. So it's just such embodied, manifest, minute parts that constitute a composition's aesthetic content, rather, I would say, than disembodied compositional ratiocination. Parts that are made manifest in performance, that emerge as salient in embodied performance, that's a redundancy, that emerge as salient through comparative or relational juxtaposition, and that, now to say it too succinctly, really, that I want to say that determine the meaning of the work. So, part four, what I want to call circumstantial sense. In a remark in 1940, Wittgenstein directly links this thoroughgoing aesthetic particularism with the causal model of misappropriated from an oversimplified conception of scientific explanation in his lectures on aesthetics. He observes that the insidious power of the causal picture is that it leads us to say things such as, we say, of course, it had to happen like that, where, in response to some aesthetic effect, where believing ourselves to be observing the same effect in each of two cases, we infer the same cause leading to that effect. Now, things get intricate here. Given the specificity of the philosophical grammar and the sense-determining relations as they emerge within a particular linguistic or artistic or compositional, a musical language game, we ought rather to say, as he says, it may have happened like that, and also in many other ways. That is, any attempt to identify and articulate a language of music where this phrase is taken to mean a system of causal regularities, such that a given chord sequence, or a given melodic movement, or a given rhythmic pattern will invariably function as the cause to a predictable emotive effect, would be constructed on this false, that is, context-invariant model. In short, this would be to take a false picture of linguistic understanding and derive from it a misleading picture of musical experience. So, with that in mind, later in the same year, he writes, the aim of music, to communicate feeling, he puts that in quotation marks, he's considering the thought. Someone says, the aim of music is to communicate feeling. Okay. Now he says, connected with this, we may say correctly, his face has the same expression now as previously, even though measurement, he says, yielded different results on the two occasions. Measurement, physical measurement, yields different results, and we say rightly, correctly, same expression. His face bore the same expression as he did last Tuesday when he heard the sad news. It was something of that kind. Then showing that this fact of aesthetic perception, in this case of the recognition of facial expression, is itself, not artistic but aesthetic, is itself internally connected to the point concerning the contextually embedded nature of the grammar of a given aesthetic expression, where the criteria for the use of an aesthetic term are not invariant across all cases of that term's sensible employment. Wittgenstein adds, how do we use the words the same facial expression? How do we know that someone is using these words correctly? And then, moving to still another refinement now, still another level of nuanced particularity, he adds, but do I know that I'm using them correctly when I say Jones has the same expression as he did last Tuesday? Where this question is intended to call attention to the fact that only within certain, and certainly not generically or in all cases of the same use of the terms, only in certain contexts will the question of the correct use of such terms or phrases so much as arise. So that too is circumstantial. That too, the sense of it is circumstantially determined, and whether it arises a problem will be a matter of its context and nothing else exported or transferred in from some other context in the name of context invariance. And then still, beneath this, we now layers down, his latter question links an epistemological to a linguistic point. Our sensible use of the phrase may not depend, our using the phrase, that's the same expression, or Jones has the same expression as he did last Tuesday, may not depend invariably on the speaker's knowledge that he's using the term or phrases correctly. Both questions of knowledge and of correctness will arise or not circumstantially. These are indeed minute and often, in Longfellow's terms, unseen parts. And the close scrutiny of them shows us about linguistic meaning, about artistic and musical meaning, and about the linguistic practices that are interwoven throughout aesthetic life. But so I want to come next then, given the linguistic practices of which we are masters that are interwoven throughout aesthetic life, I want to turn now to section 5, musical sense and linguistic capacities, linguistic abilities. So be all that as it may, given what I've said today, music is an art that possesses the power to continually reawaken the Cartesian conception of experience, that is, that the outer sensation is the stimulus for a hidden, inner, intangible event ontologically separate from the outside world and inviolably private to the hearer. And not least among the reasons for this power to reanimate the Cartesian image is music's transient nature as sound. Unlike painting or sculpture, it's not the kind of thing one can encounter as a stable physical object. The phrase, while the music lasts, is instructive. We would not know, I think, quite how to take the phrase, while the painting lasts, or while the architecture lasts. At a time that Wittgenstein is turning his attention to the philosophy of psychology, he writes, he says, once again, what is it to follow a musical phrase with understanding, or to play it with understanding? He says, don't look inside yourself. Consider rather what makes you say of someone else that this is what he is doing. And he shortly thereafter offers the reminder, excuse me, when you say of someone that he is experiencing a theme intensely, he says, just consider how this is embodied. Yet it is, as he is acutely aware, all too easy to catapult now to the polemical antithesis of the Cartesian picture of experience, that is, to behaviorism on the other side. He thus writes, one might get the idea that experiencing a theme intensely consists in sensations of the movements, etc., with which we accompany it. with which we accompany the sonic experience. But this behaviorist reduction of experience is, I think, just as wide of the mark, albeit to the other side, as its polemical opposite. In truth, this is just another picture, in his distinct sense of that term, that is an oversimplifying conceptual model that cultivates insensitivity. We do, quite evidently, make coherent and, I think, irreplaceable and irreducible distinctions within circumscribed language games between the inner and the outer. But instructively, we do not do so in a way that corresponds to a generic or a trans-contextual ontological divide. Our experience descriptions, and of course, we should also remember, we do not invariably, and perhaps do not so often, describe experience. But our experience descriptions, where they happen, are far more intricate than any crude dichotomy between the inner and the outer. And like aesthetic language, these terms assume their life within and not across context of usage. And this fact about language is then directly parallel to a musical theme, a motif, a melodic idea, a harmonic progression, a rhythmic pattern or sequence. And because of that, we have the impossibility of the dream of a fixed language of music. Wittgenstein once identified one of the difficulties of philosophy is saying, is saying what one knows and no more. And no more. Again, it sounds like a kind of quietism, but I'm not so sure. This calls attention to the frequently unchained impulse to generalize from a few, even from one, a few cases or even from one case, in order to satisfy a desire for overarching accounts of philosophically relevant phenomena that would impose order on the relative chaos of diverging particularities, impose conceptual neatness on the messiness of individual cases. They are messy. But as we've seen in the foregoing, it is, or I think it at least often can be, the differences that are telling. The methodological presumption of long-standing, that is, that philosophical progress requires the imposition of order and alignment of such details, is one that Wittgenstein is repeatedly questioning here. His conception of progress concerns the clarification of a complex view, rather than the imposition of an overarching structure. And it's for this reason that Wittgenstein does not embrace any generic claim concerning, as we saw a moment ago, music as a language. Rather, he considers, once again, but here now in these remarks in a new depth, he considers some details that give content in circumstantially specific ways to the analogy between music and language. So he writes, "If you ask me, how did I experience a theme? Perhaps I answer as a question, or something of the sort. And our ability to discern such internal comparative relations, that is to hear two successive phrases in music as antecedent and consequent, or as question and answer, is dependent upon our mastery of language. Thus, the sense-making relational interconnections that we perceive internal to a composition, that is, within the musical structure itself, and this is the point I want to make in this section, our ability to perceive those relations inside a structure of music depend on language and linguistic abilities, which are, of course, after all, external to that musical work. So this is one of the facts that calls into question the dubious distinction mentioned earlier, one that perhaps is too often employed without sufficient caution, between that which is internal to the work and that which is external to it. Our sense-making capacities in language are underwriting our sense-making capacities in music, insofar as we hear phrases as assertions, as questions, as answers, as calls, as responses, and so forth. We hear all that in music all the time. So here I think it can be helpful to suggest that one wants to say what one knows and no more. It is true that in this sense the linguistic capacities are seen to underwrite the musical in a sense, but we would do well to stop there in terms of proceeding to a higher level of generality. That is, observing this connection is not at all to explicitly say or implicitly suggest that therefore all musical sense is dependent upon or posterior to linguistic sense. Why? Well, there are particular cases where we can say with equal plausibility precisely the reverse. That is, where our capacities for musical discernment underwrite or make possible our hearing of subtleties or nuances of meaning in prosody or in language. But anyway, in this context now, in the philosophical aesthetic remarks we're now considering, Wittgenstein is pursuing the prior ordering, that is, language to music, and he writes, "Doesn't the theme point to anything beyond itself? The musical theme point to anything beyond itself?" "Oh, yes," he says. "But this means the impression it makes on me is connected with things in its environment. For example," he says, "with the existence of," for him, he says, "the German language and its intonation. But that means with the whole range," he says, "of our language games." Now, the structural sense of the music taken internally into itself, that is where we hear, say, absolute music rather than program music, that sense, that structural sense of the music, internal music, is again a mode of relational sense derived from capacities that are really foundational of our capacity to so much as make sense at all of anything external to the piece. Thus, we immediately get the remark from Wittgenstein. He says, if I say, for instance, here it's as though a conclusion were being drawn, here as though someone were expressing an agreement, or as though this were a reply to what came before. That is, he says, my understanding of it presupposes my familiarity with conclusions, expressions of agreement, replies, and so on. It depends upon it, and this is to say, I want to suggest, this is really the point of this section, that the coherence we hear in music, one might say the conversational coherence, or here also the grammar of music in Wittgenstein's sense, is indeed sometimes contingent upon our mastery of the language against which, in these respects, music is being compared. But then to avoid distortion of other cases, one wants not to say anything more general than the cases at hand warrant. One wants to say, as he suggests, no more than one knows. So, lastly, section six, his phrase, the theme interacts with language. So if I were you, I'd want to ask, well, now tell me more about then this interaction between abstract music unto itself and the sense we make of it that's parallel to our ability to identify a question, an answer, and all sorts of relations thematically inside language. What is the nature of the interaction? Section six, one strong attraction that may be felt here is toward a kind of Platonism. Here we might want to say that the mold for the theme as question and its thematic consequent, that theme's answer, exists prior to the creation, the composing of them. Thus, on hearing the sense necessity of a theme's being repeated in order to give it its tremendous power, Wittgenstein asks, don't we have an impression that a model for this theme already exists in reality and the theme only approaches it, only corresponds to it, if this section is repeated, he asks. That is, working with and from the analogy to language, I want to suggest that we might well say, this is manifesting an impulse to Platonize now, we might say that the ghostly image, or again the mold, but of a mental or intangible kind, is preordained by the form of the question-answer structure in language, or in the case of the sense necessity of repetition, by the form of emphatic restatement. Say, in language, we have to repeat something in music, we feel it's necessary to do so, and we take that sense of necessity from, we're able to discern the necessity of restatement of repetition in music because of our ability to, in fact, recognize the need for restatement in language. And the sonic realization of it is then just a post-factum realization of a prior form. Yet this, as I think we sense as quickly as we say it, seems to falsify compositional creativity. Composition is creative, and not the sonic analog of paint by numbers. And so Wittgenstein retorts to his own Platonic suggestion, that is, all composers are doing is filling these abstract forms with particular musical material. He says, yet there just is no paradigm apart from the theme itself. Recall earlier today, the meaning of the sentence can't be separated from the sentence. You don't read the Aeneid by reading a plot summary of the Aeneid. This retort restores the autonomy of the compositional intelligence, but this is delicate and it seems to make the thematic structure perhaps too autonomous, too separate from, as he said earlier, he says, the whole range of our language games, and he says, our familiarity with conclusions, expressions, agreement, replies, and so locked within this dialectic that gives voice to the impulse to generalize, to say more than we know, we next see now to himself a new retort to the previous retort. And yet again, he says, there is a paradigm apart from the theme. But now, after the Platonist, anti-Platonist polemic, he voices the moderating remark, namely, the rhythm of our language, of our thinking and feeling. The rhythm of our language. So, I want to say the attempt to see the intrinsic, indeed hermetically sealed, structured or conversational sense of a thematic line, of a musical line, in a manner wholly internal to the music, is then really as ultimately hopeless, and for parallel reasons, a misbegotten enterprise, I think, it's as hopeless as the attempt to theorize word meaning in generalized terms in isolation from our language games and the form of life within which they emerge. One can imagine, by the way, if you stop just for a moment there, to imagine how poorly one equipped only, imagine a person equipped only with formal semantics and a theory of direct reference, nothing but that, and then send them out into this world. That would be a catastrophe of the worst kind. In fact, I'm not sure we'd have a human being there, but that's another matter. And that would be as poorly equipped as would a musician, really only a sound maker, in fact, a musician who is equipped with nothing but a fixed set of isolated or atomistic sounds. I have this sound, I have that sound, I have this sound, I put them all together, I follow the score, I play sounds in order. A fixed set of, indeed, isolated or indeed, to go back to a theory of language, to atomistic sounds. So language has sense. Our signs, that's dangerously put, our signs have life in the stream of life. As he says, we should not expect melodic sense, thematic grammar, to behave any differently. And if we were to follow out a similar line of thought from the phrase, the rhythm of our language, his phrase, we would find ample reason, I think, to reverse the dependency, such that our musical abilities are what seem to underwrite, to make possible, much of the expressive nuance of spoken language. To underscore the creative independence of the newly composed theme, Wittgenstein adds, and the theme, moreover, is a new part of our language. Now, to then underscore, in turn, the fact that it will function, that is to say, that it will find its use within and only within a context of musical utterance, he adds, it becomes incorporated into it. This links, by the way, to the old problem that some of you may have worked on this. It links to the old problem of the unity of the proposition, but I'll leave that for another day. So to state what we know, where these words are given meaning in the context and resonate with all the foregoing, he concludes this movement of thought with a deceptively simple line. He says simply, the theme interacts with language. Well, now, it's a seeming, but I now feel sure I've changed my mind, a seeming total change of topic when a few sentences later in these notebooks, he writes these words as an imagined quotation. He writes the word farewell. He then follows this with a remark. When I first read that, I thought, well, it changed entirely now, back to questions of linguistic meaning, and he's doing something else entirely. But he follows this with the remark, a whole world of pain is contained in these words. His next antecedent for, composers and analysts in music, musicologists talk about antecedent and consequent phrase structure. Well, his next antecedent phrase, the question-answer form, the question, how can it be contained in them, is followed immediately by his consequent phrase, the answer. It is bound up with them. And then developing this theme, he adds, the words are like an acorn from which an oak tree can grow. Okay, metaphors. To attempt to give a sealed and unitary definition of the meaning of this imagined or remembered painful use of the words of the word farewell in the right circumstance fails to acknowledge the occasion-specific contributions, the human network within which this expression is used, or really the stream of life from which it emerges. Trying to give the atomistic meaning of a melodic line starting at middle C, descending up to a D, and ascending again to an E-flat, then falling back to a D, independently of the context, would be blind, I think, or deaf to parallel sense-determining relations. By the way, you can think of Purcell's magnificently beautiful song, Dido's Lament, in Dido and Aeneas, you have exactly that phrase structure at the beginning of the song. You also have it in Miles Davis's performance of his improvised solo in the opening sections on Autumn Leaves. You have John Coltrane using it in his extended piece Impressions. It's all over the place. A C ascending to a D to an E flat and back. I mean, you find that everywhere. It would be deaf to meaning to suggest that at bottom they're all the same. They're only sort of recontextualized. There is no, if I'm right at all about the relational determinations of sense, there is no at bottom. So Wittgenstein clearly keeps this issue in mind, and still later in 1946 we get, he says, irony in music, for example, Wagner's Meistersinger. He says, incomparably deeper in the Fugato, in the first movement of the ninth, there's something here analogous to the expression of bitter irony in speech. Bitter irony in speech, you all know it when you hear it. Well, the musicologist music historian Leon Botstein, writing on Brahms's Four Duets for Alto and Baritone, Opus 28, provides an example of just such an integration, such an indissoluble interaction of musical theme with language. And it's clear in this case that the interaction, the theme interacts with language, the interaction, the analogous expression of which Wittgenstein speaks, illuminates in both directions simultaneously. music to language, language to music, we would not here understand the content of the music fully without the emotionally descriptive language, and we may well understand that that emotionally descriptive language knew, or with a humane depth no atomistic account could begin to capture, upon hearing its analogous musical expression. Rothstein writes this. He says, though these four duets for alto and baritone represent a more mature and successful approach to the dialogic possibilities of duets than Opus 20, his earlier piece, Brahms was more than usually self-deprecating about them. Well, what was going on? They were written, Botstein says, between the fall of 1860 and the winter of 1862, and are dedicated to Amelie Joachim. Brahms maintained a particular affection for Joachim's wife when she and Joachim divorced. Indeed, Brahms' sympathy for Amelie over his old friend caused irreparable damage to his relationship with Joachim. In these songs, Botstein says, Brahms uses the contrasting voices as an ironic demonstration of imperfect or misconstrued communication between persons. Once you know that, what you hear is the actual content of those melodic interacting phrases. These are, indeed, as I called them above, sense-determining relations. And in closing, I want to suggest this. We impoverish the significance of the work if we deny, that's owing to a misbegotten allegiance to an exaggerated formalism, if we deny the significance of such relations. The pianist and musicologist Charles Rosen writes, the isolation of a work of art in a museum inevitably removes some of its significance along with the removal of context. It allows the purely aesthetic values to come forward only by pushing every other kind of meaning into the background. A public concert does the same, he says, with pieces of music. Well, one sees the point, but one also perhaps wants to say that Rosen, Charles Rosen, in referring to, recalled his phrase, purely aesthetic values, suggests a hierarchy of aesthetic value where intrinsic, non-relational, or purely formal considerations are of primary critical importance, and the relational, comparative, contextual, and language interrelated considerations are merely secondary. If the Wittgensteinian considerations we've considered are running at all along the right tracks, it's only a suggestion, this distinction is seriously called into question precisely because of the very possibility of describing the content of the work of music without such relational considerations was already in question. And one wants really to say that really some public concerts do what Rosen describes. His observation points out the considerable aesthetic value of concerts, a series of concerts that, again, like a certain kind of creative curatorial work, like a kind of curatorial presentation, places works of music into complex relation-displaying settings. So, in a more lengthy entry of 1948, and I close with this, in one in which Wittgenstein considers and dismisses a number of false generalized reductions. It's not that each one doesn't have its place, it's that no one is the essence. He considers that, musical understanding might be related to a dance step, to pictorial programmatic images, third, to the kind of causal linkage between stimulus and response we discussed above, fourth, to awakened recollections from the past, fifth, to gesturing in time with the music, and sixth, to kinesthetic sensations. He emphasizes, of those six possibilities, the very idea of determinate experiential content that constitutes the essence of musical understanding is itself seriously misleading. And this is true not only for its power to reinsinuate the Cartesian picture. Wittgenstein says here, importantly, I think, for contemporary aesthetics, that to understand a piece of music means to understand music as a whole, as a culture-wide, practice-embedded, complex set of phenomena. This stands parallel to and shares a kind of interdependent, mutually illuminating meaning with his remark early in the Blue Book that to understand a sentence means to understand a whole language. So sometimes such musical understanding will be not signified by, that way of putting it can be complicit with the Cartesian picture, not really signified by, but rather manifest within, you might say. Musical understanding will be manifest within facial expressions, gestures, the comparisons drawn in the images chosen to illustrate that understanding, or indeed simply the particular way in which a person plays or hums the piece in question. A conductor's work, by the way, extending from first rehearsal to final performance, would constitute the maximum manifestation of all of these taken together. Look at what a conductor actually does in front of an orchestra from the first performance to from the first rehearsal to the final performance, and you see a kind of compendium of exactly these kinds of things. Thus, like the understanding of a sentence, or more precisely, the understanding of a microcosm meaning within language, like the word farewell, rightly understood, the understanding of a phrase, a theme, an exposition, the musical logic of a development section, the now relationally enriched recapitulation of an exposition section in a classical symphony, the hearing of the progressive developments that are undertaken within a set of variations, and so forth through countless cases of music, will occur within our cultivated sensibilities. Recall Wittgenstein's opening remarks for today, will occur within our cultivated sensibilities within the stream of musical life. And that stream itself, as Wittgenstein has already suggested in numerous ways throughout these remarks, considered here as well in his as in his earlier lecture on aesthetics, that itself is in part, in his resonant phrase, it interacts with something much larger. Now he sums this up in a sentence that really exemplifies what it describes, a sentence that when I first read it, or when read in isolation, can itself seem too general, too indeterminately bounded, and perhaps too grand to be of much help. But I've reread it, and seen against the background of all the preceding, all these issues for today taken together, or when taken in a way that is enmeshed within all that he's now said about aesthetic understanding, I think considerably more of its broad and deep significance becomes comprehensible. His sentence is simple. It is, the appreciation of music is a manifestation of the life of mankind. Thank you.